Hi, this is Nicole Hemsoth, editor of HPC Wire, here with today's edition of Soundbite, our daily interview series featuring researchers, thought leaders, and newsmakers in the world of high-performance computing. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Larry Smarr, a physicist whose work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign on calculating black hole collisions led him to champion a federal commitment to boost U.S. computing power, which in turn led to the development of NCSA Mosaic, the precursor to web browsers. His research is certainly multifaceted and has drawn much attention and a number of awards, including most recently the Golden Goose Award, which we'll touch on today. Dr. Smarr is currently a professor of computer science and engineering at the University of California, San Diego, and directs the California Institute for Telecommunications and Information Technology. Hi, Larry. It's so nice to have you on today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
And congrats on the Golden Goose. So this is a new one to me. Can you tell us about that award? I think you're the first recipient, correct?
I'm the first recipient in 2014. It started about 2 years ago, and they have several people like me that they select each year. I also had never heard of it, but it's actually a great program. What it is you may remember Senator Proxmire used to have the Golden Fleece Award, in which he would hold up to ridicule some title of a National Science Foundation grant that sounded weird, you know, the sex life of fleas or something like that. And so this was very damaging to the making the case in Congress for continued increase in funding for basic research across the federal agencies. So a bipartisan set of congressmen, both Republican and Democrat, got together with the scientific professional agencies, like the American Association of Universities and then the AAAS and so forth, and created the Golden Goose Award, in which they took examples of basic research that you would sort of scratch your head and say, really? This is important for us to be funding? And then if you follow along, before long, there is a huge impact that's completely unexpected on society and a return on that investment to the United States. And in my case, you know, my first grant from the NSF was, I guess, 1979, and it was for using supercomputing to compute the head-on collision of two non-rotating Schwarzschild black holes starting at rest. Now, this for sure is something that will never happen in the real world. Yes, there are black holes, and yes, they collide, but they're spiraling in and so forth. But the supercomputers of the time weren't anywhere near powerful enough in the late 70s, early 80s to compute the whole spiral in. So we, of course, did an axisymmetric case instead of two black holes just coming toward each other. But what that was doing was actually putting in the basis for how you would solve Einstein's equations for general relativity for the general case, which in the last few years now has been done by multiple groups to get the gravitational waves coming off of spiraling in black holes. And that, in fact, is going into the second and third generations of gravitational wave observatories. But what that led to was my realizing if supercomputers are so useful for this one narrow field, wouldn't they also make breakthroughs across the board? And that's what led me to gather up, I guess, the largest collection of stories from scientists of how their work was blocked in academia by not having supercomputers available. That led me to, in 83, put in the first unsolicited proposal to build a national supercomputer center, and by 85, NSF had done the whole national supercomputing program.
Right. You definitely helped spearhead a lot of those efforts. I'm most curious to ask you where you think supercomputing is going. I know you follow a lot of the hardware and software trends. What do you see coming up in the next 5 years, 10 years, or even move farther out and look even farther ahead? Is it quantum computing? Is it something totally unrecognizable?
I think so. It is most likely. I mean, quantum computing will certainly proceed. But the big change I see coming is moving from human-engineered computers, which we've been doing since, you know, certainly von Neumann, and you could all argue all the way back to the ones that were being made with gears and so forth, to biologically inspired computing. Here's the easiest way to think about it. As we move, you know, I've been through the megaflop supercomputer to the gigaflop to the teraflop to the petaflop over my career. And, we had to come up with something. But if you look at, you know, the petaflop computers today, they're made out of just conventional multi-core with GPUs, say at Oak Ridge and Blue Waters at NCSA. But if you look toward the next one, where we're going to the exaflop by, you know, say 2020, you're talking about probably something like 100 megawatts of electricity needed for that machine. Now, the human brain, depending on how you calculate it, and it's always a little dicey, but there's multiple ways to get at it, it's got to be somewhere between a petaflop and an exaflop per brain.
Mm-hmm.
And, you run at about somewhere between 50 and 100 watts. So a million times more energy efficient than a 100 megawatt exascale computer. And so since power and the dissipation of heat is becoming the constraining factor in designing supercomputers, if you can gain a factor of a million in efficiency, that's just going to happen. And so you're beginning to see, for the last few years, IBM, for instance, has a number of programs involving what we call brain-inspired computing. You're seeing companies like Qualcomm that are very deeply getting into what they call neuromorphic chips. You're seeing people like Ray Kurzweil, who was has written for many years about the singularity where artificial intelligence becomes more powerful than human intelligence. And he's been hired by Google, and they gave him the keys to the planetary computer. And so, he just wrote this book, how to build a mind. So I think that we're already in the transition. But it's going to happen at the same time that we're going to nanoelectronics, so carbon nanotubes and this sort of thing, probably self-assembling computers. I mean, the other big difference between human-engineered computers and biological computers is biological computers are evolved, whereas human computers are built to blueprints.
Mm-hmm.
And those are just very, very different. I mean, they're different almost every way you think about it.
Right. You mentioned carbon nanotubes and the idea of self-replicating machines building up towards this. But what are some of the technologies in the here and now that will eventually morph? Can you name a few things that we should keep an eye on besides carbon nanotubes?
Well, the fundamental thing about it is as line widths have gotten smaller and smaller and smaller, the fundamental physics that is beginning to change is that quantum effects were always a tiny perturbation that you could work your way around. But as the line widths, it's real simple. As the line widths approach multiple atoms in width instead of thousands of atoms, then it's pretty obvious that quantum mechanics is going to become the dominant effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the problem, is you try to shrink and shrink. The thing we've been working, that's the thing that makes Moore's Law happen, is shrinking line width in two dimensions on your chip. And we've been doing that for decades. But, the world is made of atoms. And so when, there is a discrete length scale in nature, and that's as we're approaching it, either we're going to have to completely redesign our machine tools, our design programs to essentially build quantum mechanical computers, not because we want to do quantum computing, but because we can't design a computer chip that'll work if we don't include quantum mechanics and not just classical mechanics in its design. And so on the other hand, starting down at the nano level and building up with single electron transistors and carbon nanotubes and graphene and all these things, it's like these two lines are coming together. So I think what's going to happen is these little experiments you're seeing now, can self-assembly actually work? Can you have directed self-assembly that provides a reliable but scalable chip? When you think about, there's a billion, you know, transistors and et cetera on a chip, modern chip. It's a long way to a billion from, say, 10, which is sort of where things are now, or 100. And so, you know, the thing is, you can't just go directly. I mean, we went from discrete components in the 70s until a billion integrated transistors on a multi-core chip today, through many generations of machine tools, of fabs, of software design tools, in a learning process. We didn't just invent a billion core thing. That's not how it works. There were people all over the world engaged in this. And so I think there's going to be a real transformation of the existing chip world into something very different. And I think that itself is really more than getting down in the weeds, to really look at that global production and how it begins to change, how it will have to change.
You know, and so often we're talking about the hardware technologies, the materials that we need to get us there, but the, you know, the second big problem, even as we look to exascale, are the programming models, you know, the software environments that are going to be needed. You know, is there going to be a major, do you predict a major gap between hardware capability and software expertise and capability there?
Absolutely. You know, a number of us have tried for years to get more basic funding into the computer science of large-scale computing. You know, if you think about the fact that we've sort of topped out at a gigahertz for our chips, which is why we're having to do multi-core, because you can't really, you know, make the chips much faster. So you just use more of them on to use up the shrinking space. Well, how many gigahertz transistors do you need, or gigahertz chips do you need to make an exascale computer? You need a billion of them. Now, let's if you just think about, say each of those chips only has one soft failure a year, how many per second on that whole computer are failing? I mean, it's like going back to the ENIAC, where they had to go around taking out the tubes that kept failing, right? I mean, that's what an exascale is going to be like. And so you've got to have software that is way beyond fault tolerant, because essentially you'll never get the same answer twice, because the chips won't stay working underneath your software, your application software. So it's going to be probabilistic, essentially.
What are some? We talked about some of the materials and hardware technologies that might eventually get us there. So are there any particular software programs or research efforts underway that you think are worth watching?
Well, I think this whole issue of how do you get probabilistic aspects into both software and hardware. Another reason I say you have to have biologically inspired computing is, if you've got a billion nodes, you're sort of, again, intersecting the kind of scale that we see in biological systems. So you probably have a trillion, 10 trillion, a trillion neurons, something like that, in your brain. And so you've got a billion here. So you're within a factor of 1,000 of the human brain. Now, if you take a mosquito brain or something like that, you know, you're not far off with the number of components. Mm-hmm. And And so this brittle, I guess is the thing I would say, the brittle way that we currently build computers and program them, where every line of the code has to be exactly right, where every, you know, where you have this very logical development time in a completely deterministic way. That's the way we do software. That's the way we build the hardware. That's got to change. That will not continue to work into the future.
Right. You know, if you look at some of the developments on the quantum systems, I mean, the big challenge there, as we said, is on the software side, just getting code to run on it. What types of problems can some of these future machines tackle that at this point are, even with quantum computing technology where it is, that just, you know, can't be tackled now?
Well, I think that, you know, what we've seen is during my lifetime is we've gone from, you know, looking at a complex thing from a one-dimensional to two-dimensional to three-dimensional to time-dependent three-dimensional to then highly detailed in space three-dimensional. So imagine you're doing an airplane. Now you've got this giant engineering database that you're coupling in three dimensions, and then you're doing the dynamics of the airflow around this thing as it goes through various flight aspects. And so if you look forward, you're probably going to see more evolutionary things, like take living cells. I mean, can you actually, the first full simulation of a living cell, the one with the smallest DNA known, was published like a year or two ago in Cell. Well, now imagine that you have 1,000 times more computing power, and that means you, to use it, you have to know the details of the system that you're simulating also, much greater detail. But there's people all over the world working on different aspects. There's all kinds of new technologies to let you see inside of cells and to see the dynamics of the cell and so forth. So I think actually simulation of living creatures, starting at the cell, working up through tissue, is going to be one of the major new frontiers. That means that all kinds of things open up in biomedicine where if you can actually predict what the impact of a drug, say, is on a virtual cell, you know, for instance, we might be able to use a lot less lab animals. There could be a way to go through, say, you know, 100 million possible compounds and find one or two that need to be looked at in vivo. So I think that's one of the things. The other, of course, is climate. I mean, what our species is going to be involved in primarily for the next so many centuries is adapting to a constantly changing global climate, and which is locally causing wild, by our current standards, variations in rainfall and storm intensity and so forth. Well, the population is going to require there to be tools to help give probabilities of what is going to happen in my city, my coastline, all over the world. And that means they're going to require climate codes at a level of precision that are far beyond anything we've ever done. So again, that's, the Earth is, you know, a living planet. So its atmosphere wouldn't be full of oxygen if we didn't have life on the planet. And so the coupling of living material to the world of physics and chemistry in really accurate climate models is, again, one of these things that even an exascale may not be enough for.
Right, absolutely. Dr. Smart, I could spend hours talking to you if you would grant it, but we'll have to end here for now. I really appreciate the perspectives, and we'll definitely keep an eye on some of these trends as we go forward through the year. Thanks so much for taking time today.
It's been my pleasure.